Okay, good to see everybody this morning. As you can tell from the title slide, this will be the eighth in our series on marriage and divorce. We're going to be looking at divorce in the Old Testament, yet again this morning to be the second time that we've been doing that. And to what I suspect may be the great relief of many of you, we have finally reached the halfway point. So I think there's going to be about this many left, because obviously we've got to get back to 1 Corinthians 7. We'll have three lessons in 1 Corinthians 7. I've never been able to get through it faster than that. And then likely we'll be having two lessons on Matthew chapter 19. We likely will have a couple of other lessons that I'm still thinking about and whether or not we're going to be putting them into the series. But the reason I mention all that this morning is that it is just critically important to me that if you have not already begun to list all of your questions and or objections to the material that I've taught, please be sure to start doing that now, because surely we'll have at least one and maybe more, if there's that much interest, of additional lessons afterwards, so we can talk about what you've seen, how you feel, what you think is strong or weak in my presentation. I think I can safely say, convinced most of the people that I've talked to who've really studied with me. That would be a great deal more than the 15 hours maybe that we're going to be spending all together in our sessions here. When people sit down and work with me on it, I get to answer all of their questions. I get to show them where those answers are. You know, and typically people say, okay, well, now I get it. And so while I know a lot of people have a difficult time swimming this deep in any subject, I suppose, this one has torn up the church worse than all but one other doctrinal problem in the last century. It is still tearing apart homes. It is still tearing apart churches. It is a major problem. Satan has been using this for well over 2,000 years. I know about Hillel and Shammai. I've read the Babylonian Tractate, where those two men took their various positions. You know, and you can too. It's online for free if you just want to dig it out. But marriage, divorce, and remarriage has been a titanic controversy and one of Satan's most effective and destructive tools for a couple of millennium now. So I've decided this time to go at it much more thoroughly than usual. This is sort of the magnum opus, if you will. But there should be time for you afterwards. If you will, please, you know, come to me with your questions and objections, and we'll talk about that in due time. So we've had the first of our divorce in the Old Testament classes last week. And number one, we looked at Leviticus chapter 20 and verse 10, which I used to think was just the end-all be-all on marriage and divorce. Leviticus 20 and 10 says, if a man commits adultery with another man's wife, some other things there, the adulterer and the adulteress shall surely be put to death. So I understood, shall surely meant that everyone, without exception, we won't have to deal about marriages afterwards. There isn't anybody that's in a second marriage. If they're being faithful Jews, they just kill them, you know, and so we don't have to talk about divorce. In later years, I began to realize that was a bit simplistic, and that's because if we have two or more witnesses, then we can put them to death. That will virtually never happen, and never happens in the biblical record, because very few people commit adultery out in the streets. They usually do that, you know, in a very sneaky way. So when fornication gets involved, people start committing that sin of nakedness. When they're involved with porneia, as the Old Testament's described it, when they're getting naked with people they shouldn't, you know, we're not going to put them to death because we don't have witnesses. That's the first mistake that I've made. Then, number two, we looked at Numbers chapter 5, verses 11 through 31. I'm greatly condensing that, as we looked at it in more detail last week, and even then didn't read all the verses. But if a wife goes astray and a man has intercourse with her and she is undetected, there is no witness and she has not been caught in the act. So now we have a man who suspects his wife. He's got good reason. He himself may, you know, have uncovered letters or who knows what. But again, she's undetected. There's no witness. So we can't put her to death. But under the old law, they could administer the waters of bitterness, sometimes called the waters of jealousy. And then if she's guilty, she's cursed, she's barren, and she bears her guilt. which, as I understand it, means, well, we didn't have any witnesses, it said so, and in the bearing of her guilt, Deuteronomy 24 now applies. Deuteronomy's 24, first four verses, is what to do when, now you know, you're sure as a husband, but you don't have the witnesses. Here we're even more sure, God has identified her as such, but we still don't have more than one witness, so you would apply Deuteronomy 24. Number three, we looked at Deuteronomy 22. In Deuteronomy 22, verses 13 through 21, again, I'm racing through this material. We didn't go, through every verse. But if a man takes a wife, goes into her, and then turns against her and publicly defames her, saying, "When I came near her, I did not find her a virgin." This defamation, this besmirching of her good name, is a big deal. So the parents are going to bring the proof if they can, and if she's proven innocent by the parents, which I didn't get into at all, you can ask me about that later if you like, but he's going to be fined 100 months wages, that's 8 years and 4 months, and then even if she commits adultery and we have witnesses, he can't divorce her. Well, I guess with witnesses she would be put to death then, pardon me for that, but he can never divorce her then. And so he's made a titanic mistake, and surely nobody in his right mind would take this course if, as I used to think, Deuteronomy 24 taught that you could divorce her for less than adultery. You could divorce her for any reason at all. You could divorce her Hillel's way, which was for burning the toast. That's what I used to think. Well, it's incorrect. If a man takes a wife, he goes in and turns against her, publicly defames her, said, "I didn't find her a virgin," he would probably be sold into slavery for that mistake, because few people have 8 years and 4 months worth of wages, stacked up. So, you wouldn't do this. If you could just free and easy divorce a woman for any cause at all, as I used to think Deuteronomy 24 taught, Moses made a concession, he hardened her heart toward God, so he let them have their way. That's what I used to think. Well, why would a guy go through this when he could just throw her overboard two chapters later? If she's guilty, she will be stoned to death, as apparently the parents now act as more than one witness because they cannot produce the proof that she was a virgin. So number four. Number four last week is Deuteronomy 24, the first four verses. Here's a portion of it. When a man marries a wife and she finds no favor in his eyes because, and I spent over 20 years acting like the because didn't even exist. Unfamiliar with the word nakedness that followed, then I thought, well, we'll just think of this in terms of some translations have, for instance, once quoted in Matthew 19, indecency. A lot of things except nakedness, you were translating it much the way a lot of people do baptism. They're not translating it at all. But when I discovered it was a matter of nakedness, and he divorced her because of that, because of the Old Testament's porneia, which we studied at some length the last couple of lessons, because of nakedness in her, because of porneia, because of fornication, then he can give her a certificate of divorce. So we pointed out last week, brethren, just in the book of Leviticus, chapter 18, there are 19 times this word nakedness is used. Every one of them has to do with porneia, as the Septuagint would translate the word harlotry. In other words, in the Greek of Jesus' time, when they're reading a Greek translation of the Old Testament, and throughout all the 1,500 years that Moses' law had been in effect up to that point, those people knew what nakedness was. Hillel didn't like it. Hillel decided he was going to find a way to divorce wives for any cause at all. He thought he could find it in the writ of divorce, and so did the Pharisees of Jesus' day. We'll spend a lesson or two on Matthew 19 on whether or not you want to agree that the Pharisees were correct. I think the Pharisees were wrong, but for over 20 years I believe they were right. In Matthew 19, I thought they came and said, "Can we divorce our wives for any reason at all?" And Jesus responded, "Yes, you can, because Moses said you could in Deuteronomy 24. I would have sided with the Pharisees. I now think Jesus was criticizing the Pharisees for misunderstanding Deuteronomy 24. The nakedness in Deuteronomy 24, you're going to give her a certificate of divorce because of nakedness, means because of porneia, because of fornication, because of sexual sin. There's 19 of them in Leviticus that have been the law of the land for 39 years. So after you give her a certificate of divorce, though, in Deuteronomy 24, and there's not very many that argue with this, she's perfectly free to marry another man, except a priest. And she can never go back to the first husband. That's an abomination, even if the second husband dies. These are important principles, and in all my, you know, very young and very firm convictions, even counseling people to break up their marriages, I've done that. I really don't think I'd understood it quite as fully as I should. We then came to Jeremiah chapter 3, verse 8. For all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I sent her away and gave her a certificate of divorce, yet her sister Judah did not fear, but was a harlot also. She engaged in nakedness also. She was guilty of porneia also. Now, this, of course, is one of those very rare figurative uses of divorce and nakedness and, you know, porneia in your Old Testament. So you have 19 times in Leviticus your descriptions of all the sexual sins. Then you have the nakedness of the land, you know, back in Genesis. You have this passage here as well. I realize you're not necessarily talking about a sexual activity when you say that Israel was guilty of adultery because she was faithless. But it is an adulterating of the covenant. God does view himself as being married to those people, and when they consort with another god, he looks at that in its most perfect illustration as being as if his wife is in bed with another man, and he knows it. It's adultery, faithless to the covenant, taken this other person that you should not have taken. So for all the adulteries of faithless Israel, I sent her away and I gave her what? Deuteronomy 24, certificate of divorce. It only appears two times in all your Bible. Old Testament, that is. That certificate of divorce. It's there in Deuteronomy 24. If you discover your wife is guilty of one of the nakedness crimes of Leviticus 18, you give her that certificate, you can divorce her for that cause and that cause alone. She's an adulteress. Certificate of divorce proves she is, but does allow her to marry another man as long as she doesn't come back to him or marry a priest. And God, rather, is doing the same thing here. So this helps a lot, Jeremiah 38, to understand Deuteronomy 24. There's only one cause for that certificate in Jeremiah 3, adultery. And there's only one cause in Deuteronomy 24. It's exactly the same cause. She's an adulteress. She's guilty of porneia. It's defined in Leviticus. You may divorce her. You don't have to. You could forgive her. She might be absolutely desperately unhappy. She might be begging for your forgiveness. You might take, you know, mercy and compassion upon her. You don't have to divorce her. But if your heart is hardened, she finds no favor in your eyes now. Or maybe worse, and perhaps most often, she's just utterly unrepentant. Then you give her a certificate of divorce, you put her away. My heart would always be hardened toward an impenitent adulteress who had been my wife. Now, in the Old Testament's last passage, Malachi chapter 2, verses 14 through 16, let me add just a little bit to what we talked about last week. Let no one deal treacherously. What? Let no one deal treacherously. Huh? Let no one deal how? Treacherously against the wife of your youth, for I hate divorce. Somebody's behaving treacherously with regard to this divorce. This says the God of Israel, so take heed in your spirit that you do not deal treacherously. I remember he says immediately, I hate divorce. God's trying to prevent divorce. He hates divorce. There's no such thing in the Old Testament, as I once passionately and honestly believed, as easy divorce. There's no such thing as a concession to the hardness of husbands' hearts so that they can divorce their wives for any cause at all. There is no such thing as any divorce in the Old Testament that God is going to approve unless, in the Old Testament, she's committed adultery, or you've married a particular tribe of people, of nation, race of Gentiles that have been expressly forbidden you. And in the marrying of these people, you are threatening the very lineage of the coming Messiah. You are to be a people separate. We are to have those tribes without being mixed races so that we will be able to certainly identify in a particular tribe the Messiah himself. They were threatening this entire plan of salvation, the identification of the Messiah, by marrying these other people. Now, in that case, You've got to divorce them. You've got to stay away from them. You can't be producing more children by them. Those are your only two times, brethren. And they're very specific, and they're certainly not divorces for any cause at all. There's no easy, simple divorce in the Old Testament. Think about this now with Malachi, who comes a long time after Moses. He's 1,100 years after Moses. If Deuteronomy 24 allows divorce for any reason at all, if God caved in and let those evil men have their way and he said, you wives will all just have to pay for it, I'm going to let them throw you over. If there is easy divorce in the Old Testament for any reason at all, short of adultery in Deuteronomy 24, how could anyone ever deal treacherously with a wife? He can divorce her for any reason at all. So where's the treachery? Why doesn't he just tell her? Sorry, babe, but you knew when we came in, Deuteronomy 24 says I can dump you anytime I want. Any reason at all. So I'm dumping you. I'm certainly not going to risk 8 years' wages to do it. And I don't need to see you killed. I just don't like you. So I'm going to divorce you according to Deuteronomy 24. Hillel's right. They're arguing in Matthew 19. And Jesus is saying, no, he's not, and he never was. There's only one cause in Deuteronomy 24, and that cause is adultery. And if you throw a woman over who has not committed adultery, that is treachery. That divorce for less than adultery is exactly what Malachi is talking about. Divorce for adultery is allowed in Deuteronomy 24. Divorce for less than fornication is never allowed. Ever. So, how would you deal treacherously in Malachi after 1,100 years of Moses' law if you can divorce your wife for any cause at all? There'd be no such thing as treachery. There'd just be the writ of divorce. That's important. Now, let's think about this. Continuing in the Old Testament discussion. Turn to Matthew chapter 1. Matthew chapter 1, brethren, is Old Testament. So is the rest of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Under those stories that you read about in the Gospels, Jesus is alive. The very end, he will die and raise again, but he will not have sent the Holy Spirit. The apostles will not have preached that first sermon. Nobody's been baptized into Christ. And all that you read about in the Gospels, there is not yet this, I will build my church and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. It hasn't happened yet. The Old Testament continues to be in force under all the people that Jesus is talking to, and Jesus is under it too. So when you read in Matthew chapter 1 and verse 18, we got us a pretty famous case here, don't we? In Matthew 1:18, what in the world should Joseph do? The birth of Jesus was as follows. When his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, that means married enough that he'd have to divorce her to get rid of her, but they haven't slept together yet. Very strange to us in our culture for a variety of reasons, but a betrothal for the Jews is a marriage. You can only get out of it with divorce. The sex that takes place is supposed to wait throughout the betrothal, but you are married. Now, I could have a whole lesson on this, and I know other men who have. I won't do it today. But get this. Roman Catholicism, a lot of things have had influence over this. Sexual intercourse is not the consummation of a marriage, no matter what you may have heard. You are just as married if you never have sex. You are married without having sex. Sex doesn't make the marriage. If you get married, you have no sex, and then you decide to divorce, you can't say, well, I was never married. I just thought I was married. No, you were married. The marriage is in the covenant. The marriage is in the promising. The sex is a privilege thereof. Whether you ever engage in that, you're still married. Do not confuse these two, as I did terribly for many years. You don't get out of a marriage by saying, well, we never had sex. You have to divorce to do that, and these passages would still be talking about it, whether you had any sex or not. Joseph's pretty sure he hasn't slept with Mary. And he's got enough witnesses to prove it. himself. He knows he didn't do it, but she's pregnant. What should I do? Well, brethren, what are his options under the old law in which he lives? He's looking at Jesus there. He isn't even born yet. We're not under Jesus. We're under Moses. What are his options? Can he invoke Leviticus 20:10 and kill her? She is my wife. We are married. And clearly, she's committed adultery. I'm going to kill her. Well, why not? Because there are no witnesses. Well, okay, number two. I'll invoke Numbers 5 in the waters of bitterness. Brethren, she's pregnant. We know, or at least everybody in that community thinks they know, she's had sex with somebody. So Numbers 5 is about undetected and no witnesses. Well, all right, nobody saw that, and that's absolutely true. But she's pregnant. We know she is. Why are you going to go for the waters of bitterness here? And suppose you did. You're already married to her. How many people might just scratch their heads and say, well, Joseph is claiming he didn't do it, but who's the prime suspect in our crime here? How many guys would lie about that? How many guys would change their mind through the betrothal, don't want to do the divorce? That's very problematic for him. He's not going to do that. So in Deuteronomy 22, I'll claim she wasn't a virgin. Well, wait a minute. He knows he hasn't been with her. He shouldn't know whether or not she's a virgin. But he knows he hasn't been with her. So, okay, I'm going to claim that she was not a virgin when I took her. Number says, is an admission now that he's been sleeping with her and he wasn't supposed to. Is he going to do that? Well, no. So now comes what? We know she's pregnant. We know, we think as human beings at that time that she must have been with somebody. But Joseph here, brethren, he's got a really big problem that often gets left out of all of this. What does every woman in Israel want above all things to happen to her in Jesus' day? And what does Isaiah 7:14 say? One of these days, a virgin is going to have a baby. Now, here's poor Joseph looking into Mary's eyes, and he loves her or he wouldn't want to marry her. He trusts her or he wouldn't want to marry her. She says, I'm the girl. What's he supposed to do? What is he supposed to do? Well, brethren, we're told in the next verse he's a righteous man. So what does he do? The only option he's got is Deuteronomy 24. So he's confused. He's unhappy. He doesn't want to marry her. No angels come to him yet. She finds no favor in his eyes. He's hardened his heart against her. Now, that's one of those lessons I may do. For all of you that think that hardness of heart is always evil, can never be excused under each and every conceivable circumstance that a hardness of heart is ever invoked, it is condemned. You're not allowed to ever do that. You better start thinking like I had to do. So I used to sing that song too. Brethren, if your heart is not hardened perpetually against child abuse, there's something wrong with you. If your heart is not hardened against adultery, God's not pleased with you. If your heart is not hardened against murder and theft and lying and false witness and everything else that's in the Ten Commandments and everywhere else before Moses and after Moses that God's ever defined as sin. If you don't harden your heart against those things, if you're open and receptive to those things, then you've really got a problem. Because a person with that kind of heart, that is a heart that is not hardened towards sin, is going to find God hardening his heart toward them. You've got to rethink this whole hardness of heart thing. Be happy to do it. Maybe I'll do a whole lesson. We'll see. But you've got to rethink that. I want you to know right now, my heart is as hard as diamonds. Every time I find out about some little girl that gets kidnapped, raped, and murdered. And I'm never going to feel good about it. And don't think I should. So that whole song was just wrong. Hardness of heart is when you are unreceptive and rejecting something. You may be rejecting God's will, and if so, cut that out. You've got a hardness that is not permissible. But a hard heart against all the things that God has hardened his heart against, brethren, is a pretty good idea. And one of them is waking up one morning to find out this woman you've never slept with and been betrothed to for some time is showing child. Well, is she the Messiah's mother? And with a resounding cry, we all say, yes. But Joseph didn't know that. So God understands such a hard heart, thinks that she's been involved with another guy. So perfectly understandable he's got a hard heart. God said back in Deuteronomy 24, your wife finds no favor in your eyes because you've discovered a matter of nakedness in her. She's pregnant. How do you do that without getting naked? So he invokes Deuteronomy 24. It's the only option for a righteous man. And we learn he can do it privately. He doesn't want to disgrace her. So he tries just as quietly as he can to just say, I'm going to write you a bill of divorce. Now, can she marry another man except a priest under the law that everybody's living under here? Well, sure she can. And as a matter of fact, what's Joseph thinking? Well, I hope she does. Wouldn't want the child to be without a father, but I'm not him. She ought to go marry the guy that gave this baby here to the world. That's what I'm guessing he's thinking. It's what I think I'd be thinking. So, brethren, let's continue now with the big four. Under the old law, every word of which these four passages I'm about to tell you is under the old law. We have Matthew 5, 27 through 32, Matthew 19, 3 through 12, Mark 10, 2 through 12, and Luke 16, 18. In the Gospels, this is all we've got. That is to say, under the old covenant, as everybody was in the Gospels for Matthew 5 and 19, Mark 10 and Luke 16, everybody's under the law at this time. These are the passages, though, that I used to think was where Jesus was changing the law, disagreeing with Moses, saying the Pharisees are right. You could divorce for any reason at all, but I'm putting an end to it now. And so this is where we think, I thought, many people still think, a shrinking number, I might add, and I'm not even sure if it's a majority anymore, and I think for good reasons. You know, there's a lot of people still though do think this, that these four passages demonstrate Jesus saying Moses is wrong, I'm going to raise the standard, we're going back to the way it was before Moses and the way it's always been for the Gentiles because the law wasn't given to them, we're going to go back to a higher standard. I thought that. Now let me shuffle these a little bit for you right here. Now the exact same passages, but what I'm going to do today is look at them in reverse order. So Luke 16 is a single verse. Mark 10 is exactly the same thing that we're talking about in Matthew 19 with one small, you know, little addition there. And then, you know, we got Matthew 5. So let's take Luke and Mark and just, you know, pass over those very quickly because the real meat of what we want to talk about, the fuller discussions, you know, are going to be found in Matthew 5 and in Matthew 19 anyway. And ultimately, there's only one reason why I ever thought Deuteronomy taught divorce for a lesser cause, and that's because I thought I could read it here in Matthew 19. So let's look at Luke 16. I'm going to put these up on the screen, so you've got to come into your Bibles now and have a look at it. So we're in Luke in that 16th chapter. Now, this one, you know, write it on your list if you really want to discuss it. But Luke 16's particular verse is a single verse in the midst of quite a bit of other things. It's not on this topic. It's illustrative, I think, of another topic. But it says what it says. It's true what it says. But there's not much to go on. So in chapter 16, in verse 18, it says, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. He who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery. Now, if that was all we had, if that was the sum of God's word, and therefore the whole truth on the topic, what would this mean? It would mean that the Roman Catholics are right. Roman Catholics teach, yes, you can get a divorce, but nobody can marry afterwards. Innocent, guilty, or otherwise, if you break up a marriage in their sacramental system, many of those ideas, that sacramental system we've been imbibed pretty deeply. I think I was being influenced heavily by Roman Catholicism and their thoughts about sacramental marriage. But laying all of that aside, there's no exception. There's no second marriage. That's the Roman Catholic view. Look at 16:18. It says, everyone, said whosoever, from Adam on, Jew, Gentile, if you think that's what that word means, and I don't, but it used to, still it says, everyone, so if you make that universal and absolutely absolute, then you divorce a wife. There's no exception clause. Doesn't matter if she's committed adultery in Luke 16. She's guilty of adultery, tough, you can't marry her. If you do, excuse me, you can't divorce her, and you marry another, you know, you're committing adultery. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. No exceptions. Period. Well, nobody in this room believes that, I don't think. Because we've read the exceptions in Matthew 5 and Matthew 19. We know there are exceptions. They weren't listed here. So, simple statement, everyone who divorces his wife, marries another, commits adultery. He who marries one who is divorced from a husband commits adultery. Whether adultery is involved or not, well, there is an exception. So we recognize that. We say, rightly, and so many other topics, and I think I didn't do so well with this one, context matters. The sum of God's word is truth. I better remember every word of that Old Testament before I start passing judgments on the Gospels and on 1 Corinthians 7. So we're going to just set that one aside. There's other places with more information. There is an exception. I am not a guy who believes that no matter what, if you get a divorce, you must remain unmarried the rest of your life. I don't think anybody here believes that either. Now let's go to Mark chapter 10. So you back up a gospel in Mark chapter 10, and you have verses 2 through 12. This is the perfect parallel to Matthew 19. So I'm going to pass over it more quickly, but I do want to at least just read it. In Matthew 10, verses 2 through 12. Pharisees came up to him, testing him. So now you know something about their attitude and what they wanted to accomplish. They began to question him whether it was lawful for a man to divorce his wife. He answered and said to them, what did Moses command you? They said, Moses permitted a man to write a certificate of divorce and send her away. Now you'll know from Matthew 19, that's Hillel's boys. Free and easy, any cause at all. God lowered the standard. All we got to do is, you know, fill out the paperwork. I can divorce for anything. Doesn't have to be fornication. Fornea and pornication. Now you know how bad a shape I'm really in this morning. Fornication and porneia, which the Old Testament is talking about. You know, so Jesus said, because of your hardness of heart, he wrote you this commandment. He did. He wrote Deuteronomy 24 because you busted your wife in a sexual sin. Your heart hardened as well it might and even should. So we'll let you divorce your wives for that reason alone. That's what Deuteronomy 24 says. Jesus adds, from the beginning of creation, God made them male and female. For this cause, a man shall leave his father and mother, two shall become one flesh. Consequently, they're no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. In the house, disciples began questioning him about this again. He said, whoever divorces his wife, marries another woman, commits adultery against her. And if she herself divorces her husband, marries another man, she's committing adultery. Does the exception exist in Mark 10? No. It's just like Luke 16, it's just a lot longer. So, if that was all we had, and you found your wife in bed with another man when you got home from work, could you divorce her? No. That passage says you can't. If what Jesus is doing is raising standards here, then he's taking away the exception of Deuteronomy 24, for sure. He's saying you cannot divorce for adultery any longer. Moses said you could. I won't let it happen anymore. Now, brother, that was the big mistake I was making. I was assuming Jesus was bringing all this new law and he was raising standards and going back to the way they used to be, more than Moses asked. But brethren, there is an exception and you can't just eliminate it. You can't just pretend it isn't there. It's in two other passages. So let's go find those passages. Mark 10, you know, if you're not happy with the way I'm handling it, we'll spend a whole class on it. I don't have any fear of it. later. Let's try to finish this in a hurry, and then we'll see what goes. So now, I've got about 10 minutes. I want to work on Matthew 5, 27 through 32. In all likelihood, I'll probably get a bunch of feedback, and you may want to talk about this some more next week. But for the remainder of this class, we're going to talk about Matthew 5. Please turn over there. And then we'll have one, possibly even two classes on Matthew 19. Now, how many of you were in the Sunday morning sermon series on the Sermon on the Mount here a couple of months ago? Raise your hand real high. No, do it the other way. How many of you were not? How many of you were not here for those sermons? Okay. I'm going to have to lean pretty heavily on that. Now, all of you people watching the video there, listening to it online through the church's website, I appreciate this is kind of shorting you. But let's go think about this for just a minute. In the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5 through 7, who's Jesus talking to? Jews. He was only sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Where is he in his preaching ministry? Very early, a few weeks, maybe a couple of months. Right at the start, in this little valley, probably, Jesus, I guess, standing down here somewhere with thousands of people on those hillsides, is going to preach that Sermon on the Mount. And in that sermon, he's going to preach the proper understanding and application of Moses' law in every sentence. That's my conviction, and I think I can prove it. So here's my challenge for you. Search Matthew 5 through 7. Find for me any statement in there that could not be practiced by a Jew living at that time and cannot be found in the Old Testament law of Moses. You bring me that passage, and I'll show you where you're wrong. That's exactly it. I've been working on this for a lot of years now. This is Jesus, who is a Jew, keeping the law so he can qualify himself to be our Savior, die on the cross as a sinless sacrifice, teaching Jews to keep the law on that hill. That's what Jesus is doing. Now, he has a right to talk about future kingdom, those kinds of things, but there's not one word in this sermon that you can't find in the old law and practice while you're under it. He's not taking away Deuteronomy 24. In any way, shape, or form. Not one thing is unknown to Moses' law. Look, just to give you highlights. Skip to 5, 11, and 12. I'm going to go really fast. In 5, 11, and 12, so they persecuted the prophets before you. What prophets? The Old Testament prophets. You people might experience the same thing they did. Look at 17 through 20. And I got to read this one. Matthew 5, 17 through 20. This, brethren, is Jesus' grand declaration of his whole purpose for these three chapters. 5:17. Do not think that I came to take away Deuteronomy 24. I didn't come to do that. I didn't come to abolish Moses' law or the prophets. I didn't come to do that. I didn't come to abolish it, but to fulfill it. Verse 18, truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not the smallest letter or stroke shall pass away from the law till all is accomplished. That Old Testament still serves us. Not the smallest jot or tittle has passed away, and it's still here. Why? Jesus said so. 19, whoever then knows one of the least of these commandments. What commandments? He isn't giving them anything new. Moses' commandments, the law and the prophets, you would know one of those. I thought for 20-some years, Jesus was knowing Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 through 4, right here. That's what I thought. I was just positive he was doing that. But he just said he wasn't. I worked on that. There was just ways in my head that I could get around that. One of these days, I just had to accept it. He didn't come to abolish Deuteronomy 24. Came to fulfill every law by teaching the Jews how to keep it. And then he adds, and so teaches others. Well, Jesus is the teacher. Verse 19, continuing, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. Whoever keeps and teaches them to be called great in the kingdom of heaven. Well, there's a comparison, but it gets even bigger. In 20, I say to you, unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, what law are they under? You shall not what? Enter the kingdom. We'll talk about this in another whole lesson I've got coming up. So just hold that thought. He will enter the kingdom. He's teaching about something new. That's not in the old law. Jesus coming to set up his kingdom is all over the old law. He's not annulling it here. He's not abolishing it here. He's fulfilling it here. I didn't come to do that. Then we have in 23 and 24, in the midst of these six, but I say unto you, which I used to think was Jesus arguing with Moses and saying, we're not going to have that anymore. Moses will not be allowed anymore. I'm going to abrogate Moses right here and now, is what I thought he was doing. He says, now the end result of this one is if you're presenting your offering at the altar. What altar? The altar in Jerusalem. Who's he talking to? Jews. They have to offer these sacrifices. If he tells them not to, he's breaking the law they're under and teaching them to do so. He can't do that, brethren. 47, don't the Gentiles do the same? Is the contrast. In 6, verse 7, don't pray like the Gentiles do. In 6:32, all these things the Gentiles seek. Let's go back to those first. He keeps invoking the Gentiles. Do the Gentiles matter to us anymore? That's a Jew-Gentile thing. These are Jews. He's making comparison to the people that are outside their kingdom, that are outside. They've, you know, outside the group that should have accepted God as their king. Don't be like them, he tells the Jews. Well, that doesn't work for us at all. We don't think there even are Gentiles. Look at 7:12. The golden rule is described as the law and the prophets. But I thought Jesus came in the Sermon on the Mount to give us the Christian constitution. That's a favorite expression you'll hear all over everywhere. Sermon on the Mount is the Christian constitution. Jesus bursts on the scene to say, I have something so vastly superior and better than Moses. I'm going to teach you things you can't read anywhere in Moses' law. I am bringing you the new and higher standard, the one that I bring in Christianity. Laws that some of which, and marriage and divorce is one of them, you know, were this way before Moses, but then God let Moses lower the standard, and so there's no such thing as treacherous divorce for 1,500 years. You just throw her off for any reason you like, but I'm changing that now. The brethren, the golden rule is in the law and the prophets. It's in several places, as a matter of fact. And those of you that were in my class, I gave you those verses. I don't have time to go over that this morning. Look at the first thing that happens after that sermon is over. 5-7. What's the next thing that happens? Chapter 8, verse 4, it says, show yourself to the priest and present your offering. Present the offering that Moses commanded. Now raise your hand if you think that's Christian teaching. Jesus set aside Moses' law here in the Sermon on the Mount. Here we go. We got a new constitution. So, what does 8:4 tell us? We're still supposed to be practicing Leviticus' laws with regard to uncleanness, and then people have to offer their sacrifices as Moses commanded. Well, of course not. How come it was in my mind, brethren, that I was applying all these ideas about raising standards and lowering standards and giving permissions for just the Jews for 1,500 years, and now Jesus is going to elevate it again. How come I seem to be limiting myself almost exclusively to the topic of marriage and divorce? I didn't see him doing this in anything else. Why was I thinking he was doing it here? Because I respected great and good men. I think they made the same mistakes I did. Honestly, it's okay to be honestly mistaken. As long as when you find out you're mistaken, you do something about it. Now let's look at chapter 5, verses 27 through 28. Two verses. Okay? In Matthew 5, 27 and 28, you have the second of the six contrasts. Is he contrasting Jesus' teaching with Moses' teaching? One is superior and better and will endure. The other is inferior and worse and be done away. Is that what he's comparing? He says, you've heard it was said, you shall not commit adultery. Well, sure enough, that's the seventh commandment in Exodus 20, verse 14. They had every one of them heard that. They also knew what Hillel taught about it. But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has committed adultery with her in his heart. And brethren, I preach some of the best sermons, I guess, as any guy can, about how lust is never forbidden in the Old Testament. It's okay under Moses' law. He gave us a concession. You can lust, but you just can't commit the physical act. I was one of the best Pharisees you ever saw. Right there with the pack in Matthew 19. You can divorce for any reason at all. And as long as you don't actually get physical, you can lust all you like. I used to think that. But brethren, isn't the command that you shall not covet your neighbor's wife lusting after her in your heart? Is Isn't that what that is? I'm telling you, it was awfully shocking. It was revelation. It was road to Damascus for me when I woke up enough to start finding what Jesus said in the Old Testament. And it was pretty disconcerting. I had taught people to break up their marriages. Now I realize all Jesus did here was say, "You Pharisees who think that as long as you avoid the physicality of the seventh commandment, you can break the tenth to your heart's content is not true. But I, Jesus, Son of the living God, say unto you, Moses never taught that. Moses didn't mean that. That tenth commandment is, thou shalt not lust in your heart for another man's wife." That's what Jesus was doing. How about 31 and 32 then? It was said, whoever sends his wife away, let him give her a certificate of divorce. Now, brethren, think really carefully about this. What is in that statement and what is not in that statement? Look carefully at 531. Jesus says, it was said. Not it was written. It was said. There's a big difference, I believe. Often he says it's written, not here. He says, you've heard that said. And what is that, brethren? That is a brutal misquote and abuse of Deuteronomy 24, which when the Pharisees said that, purposely took out the because of nakedness. It is one of the worst violations of the Old Testament you'll find in the mouths of those men called scribes, Pharisees, lawyers, Sadducees, and hypocrites. When you really think about that, they had twisted it brutally and turned it into you can divorce your wife for any cause at all. Jesus says, but I'm telling you what Moses said. I say to you, in my commentary on Moses, not those Pharisees, not those hypocrites, my commentary on Moses, Jesus says, is that everyone who divorces his wife except for nakedness. Jesus, what is he doing in Matthew 5? He is fully quoting and properly interpreting Moses' law. And there's only one law he can be quoting and interpreting. Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4, which I thought taught, along with all the Pharisees, that you divorce your wife for any cause at all. Brethren, it's most disconcerting when you realize you've been preaching it and how wrong you've been. Okay, we can close out right here. Makes her commit adultery, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. You know, are very intriguing things. But for the end of this class, just know, all Jesus did in Matthew 5, 31 and 32 is reference Deuteronomy 24, teach exactly what Moses always meant, and condemn the Pharisees for trying to twist it into a less than adultery or fornication divorce. Divorce for any reason at all is what those Pharisees said. What Jesus said was never. God forbid it. Thank you.